know what we're thinking.
A grizzly is an animal, Kelly. Don't give it human qualities.
See, he doesn't understand that we're dealing with a highly intelligent beast.
Welcome to Dan's Driving Double Feature number 11. This time, we're going to the water, and we are going to visit two very entertaining, well, mostly pretty darn two very watchable Jaws ripoffs. 1976's Tentacles and 1977's Claws. Yay! A giant octopus, giant bear. Should be a good time. Of course, in 1975, Jaws came out and sort of began. It was Star Wars that really kick-started everything, but it was 1975's Jaws that began sort of a summer blockbustery, big movie kind of thing that wasn't, say, like The Exorcist. You know, everyone had to go see The Exorcist, but you're not, you know, bringing a 9-year-old to that unless you're strange. But Jaws, everyone went to Jaws. Everyone went crazy for Jaws. Jaws was everywhere. Jaws was as big as the Fonz. And Star Wars. And so there were ripoffs. Lots of them. And we are going to... Hey, you know, I realize that one of these is an Ovidio Esinitis film. And when we did Exorcist ripoffs, we talked Beyond the Door. Hey, he's good at ripping things off. Although I don't know what The Visitor is a ripoff of. But hey, that's part of the joy of his movies. So, yeah, you all know Jaws. I'm not going to go into Jaws, but let's listen a little something here, and then we will dive right into breakdown of the plot for Tentacles. Tentacolo, Cali. Tentacoli? I got to look up my Italian for that. Why would I be looking up an Italian? Asinitis was Greek. What's the Greek for tentacles? I'll look it up. I'll find out. I'll get back to you.
Each year, 10,000 tourists visit Ocean Beach. This summer, Ocean Beach has attracted something else. American International presents Tentacles. It slept until man disturbed it. Then it woke with a fury no man could control, rising from the ocean floor to bring destruction and death. Tentacles. A chilling tale of nature gone wild as two of the sea's deadliest enemies fight to the death. Starring John Huston, Shelley Winters, Bo Hopkins, Claude Akins, and Henry Fonda. Tentacles, the most gripping suspense you'll ever experience. Rated PG.
Pleocumia? I think that's the Greek for tentacles. I don't know if I go see a film called that. It's not as great as Tentacles or Tentacoli. But what do I know? So, the story of Tentacles is this. It was shot in San Diego, so I'm imagining it's meant to be in the San Diego-ish area, although they reference Los Angeles a few times throughout it. A place called Seaside Town Solana Beach. Obviously, it's summer. We're getting a lot of people showing up, ready to have a good time. Unfortunately, a drilling operation being done by Trojan Tunnels, which is just a fun name for anything, which is led by Henry Fonda. Well, he's in charge. He's not leading the digging thing. But apparently this digging expedition, this tunnel, has brought up a giant man-eating octopus. And the movie begins with a great sequence where a baby is yanked off of sort of the edge of a... her mom has stopped in a little grassy, not quite a park area, right by the edge of the water, and she's sitting with the baby. Mom goes to talk to a friend for a minute, and the octopus grabs the baby. And then another guy, Bill Sullivan, they say his name about 18 times, and he's got about 3 minutes. He gets pulled into the water by the octopus and stripped bare. And we meet Claude Akins, who plays the Sheriff Robards. We meet John Huston, who plays Turner, the local newspaper guy. His sister is Shelley Winters, who's Tilly Turner, who's apparently been married a lot and has a kid. And apparently she's the older sister to John Huston. I don't know how that would work. I'm going to have to check the dates to see who was older, but it sure looks like John Huston's a lot older than Shelley Winters is. Maybe being a reporter makes you older faster. And then Bo Hopkins is a local sort of marine biologist-y kind of guy who works with killer whales. And the movie sort of goes along sort of like Jaws, more or less. It's not as big in scope, but it's, yeah, random people keep getting attacked. Generally, not those cast members I just told you about. You're not going to take Shelley Winters out to the middle of the ocean and then have an octopus attack her. She does wear a giant sombrero at one point, which we can talk about later. But the whole thing is there's a lot of people being attacked, and they're sort of trying to cover it up, but that's not really a huge thing because Turner, who's the reporter, keeps saying, "Oh, don't worry, Sheriff, I won't tell anyone about it until you give me the word." And so it's kind of being covered up, but not quite, and there's no one really pushing hard to get it looked into, and it's a strange kind of lackadaisical compared to Jaws. The setup for Jaws, but eventually, yeah, the octopus killings go on, and there's a huge yacht race, which Tilly's son and her son's best friend are part of, and that basically, it's a bunch of kids out in these little, well, it's not a yacht race, it's sort of just a little race, they're in just little boats with sails on them, and they all get attacked by the octopus, and, you know, I'm not going to tell you whether or not Tilly's son lives or dies. I'm going to let you watch the movie for that. I'm not going to spoil everything for you. And so, yeah, that's sort of the big showpiece in the movie is the octopus attacking all these kids, but it's kind of slightly underwhelming. It's kind of suspenseful, but the octopus is never sort of fully integrated well into what's going on, but it's fun to watch. And sort of the debris afterwards of all these overturned boats and these kids being brought back and everything is nicely done. And yeah, the film sort of builds and builds to the final sequence where Bo Hopkins and his assistant, who is in the movie a lot, but is very shadily drawn in, drawn in at all. It's a really weird character that he's there all the time, and he takes part in sort of the final battle against the octopus, but he's never really sort of, it's like, who is that guy? Oh, it's that guy. Who is that? That's not Bo Hopkins. That's the guy who's not Bo Hopkins. And then it all ends with, spoiler, it all ends with a big attack at the end. Ends with a big attack at the end. It ends with an attack, killer whales versus giant octopus. I'm not going to tell you who wins, but let me just say that Solana Beach is still open for business when it comes to regattas. So that's Tentacles, everybody. Listen to some of this. We'll come back and we'll talk more about it.
Who could have imagined they were there? Who could have predicted they would attack? And now, who would survive? Piranha, they're here. Piranha, they're hungry.
What's the matter with you?
Piranha, they're unstoppable.
Stop that! Hey, keep your hand out of the water.
What's wrong with the water?
The water is filled with carnivorous fish.
Piranha. They call them the devil fish because wherever they go, hell waits below.
They breed like flies. There'll be no way to stop them.
Suddenly, no one is safe. And everyone must be warned. The water is now a human death trap.
Two people have been killed up there, and more have been killed all along the river.
You gotta believe it.
These are the man-eaters who go beyond the bite of all other jaws. Sharks come alone. Piranha come in thousands. Crazed by the scent of blood, they live by the taste of flesh. With razor teeth, they can strip a man to the bone in a frozen instant of terror. Piranha. They're here. They're hungry. They'll eat you alive. Who can stop them?
Tentacles, tentacles, tentacles. I like tentacles. I don't know that I love tentacles, but I think it's definitely worth at least one viewing. I've seen it maybe three times. I have the Blu-ray Scream Factory put out with that in Reptilicus. That's a very interesting double feature, I'll tell you. It's a movie that, you know, after the craziness of Beyond the Door and The Visitor, you would think tentacles would be a little nuttier. There's a sort of strange inability to properly achieve the octopus stuff as well as it might have been achieved. I'll talk more about that in a minute. The cast, of course, is very interesting. There's that weird thing where it's like you got Henry Fonda, you got Shelley Winters, you got Claude Akins, you got Bo Hopkins, you got John Huston, and there is just the feeling throughout that, well, they're not going to kill off any of them. Well, maybe Bo Hopkins or Claude Akins, but they're not going to kill off Henry Fonda or Shelley Winters or John Huston. So there's kind of a weirdness that the three big stars of the movie are never really in danger, and that they don't participate in the big closing sequence is very odd also. And it sort of sets John Huston's character up as being like sort of like he's going to be the hero and discover what's going on, but he didn't do anything. He's kind of there for a bit, and he, you know, occasionally learns a bit of information from Claude Akins' Robards, I believe, Sheriff Robards, but that's about it. And Claude Akins does even less. It's a strange movie that never... It's fun to watch, and I don't know that it really sort of gets boring, but it never seems to actually become what it thinks it is, I guess, is the way I'll put it, because it's never that exciting, and it's obviously, I mean, he's like Asinitis is mixing up here the sort of the Jaws ripoff with like a disaster film marquee, which is interesting, and what a strange disaster film marquee it is too. But then of course the point of the disaster film marquee is you don't know who's going to die in a disaster film, so you put up these seven or eight big stars and hopefully any of them could die. You don't know. In here, look at Shelley Winters in Poseidon Adventure. In here, yeah, you know they're not going to die. And so it ends up being a lot of scenes with folks you've never seen before, some of whom are clearly not American at all, some of whom are Greek, Italian, I don't know what they are. They're clearly dubbed, and they're dubbed with those great voices of the dubbers that we love from like the 70s and the 80s. You know those folks. But the big stars use their own, have their own voices, but everyone else is dubbed with those. So it ends up being a weird movie where, yeah, the people who look like they're going to be the stars don't end up doing much. And then the people who sort of in the first half don't do much sort of become the stars in the end. And like I mentioned in the synopsis there, yeah, there's this one guy who Bo Hopkins worked with who I never got a handle on who or what exactly he was. He likes the killer whales. They like him. And they help him kill the octopus. But I never quite, that character never quite was like, I was like, I'm not getting what this character is about. But there are some nice sequences in it. There's a sequence with a woman, the boat is pulled down by the octopus, and she's hanging onto a buoy in the middle of the night, and like the octopus, like rear screen rises, projection rises up behind her. That's a pretty good moment. And then there's a moment sort of in a bathysphere kind of thing where the lights go out, and then I think they suddenly come back on, and the guy in the bathysphere turns and looks at the little porthole, and there's just a giant octopus eye up against the porthole. And the first time the octopus uses the ink on a diver, where the diver kind of goes close to this cave, gets inside, and then all of a sudden there's just this cloud of ink that sprays out, and it's like, well, craziness. And I mean, there's obviously, you can't train an octopus, and they were not going to spend money to build a mechanical octopus, so it's a strange mix of a real octopus footage and sort of miniatures, and it sometimes it really works. Sometimes it's very ominous, the sort of eyes of the octopus poking out of the water as it's floating around during the boat race there is pretty good. And some of the moments when things just suddenly get like, are just like floating in the water and suddenly get yanked away are pretty good. But then they're balanced off by the really fat guy who gets attacked by the octopus and is doing pretty good floating. He's a big fat guy. And then his friend has the most, I suppose, sort of ignominious death, where a woman is like on the boat looking for the these two guys who are out there, the fat guy and the thin guy, and then all of a sudden two legs pop out of the water. But they're like, they pop straight up out of the water. If you go online and look up maybe tentacles 1976-77 legs out of water, something like that, I bet you can find the image. But the image is very silly. I think it's meant to be, from the music and everything, very chilling, but it just looks silly. And then they kind of get yanked to the side and under the water. The music is a lot of fun in this movie. A lot of lots of harpsichord and drums pounding away, and I really like the score for it. Apparently it reappeared in Paul Naschy's Night of the Werewolf. I haven't seen Night of the Werewolf in years, so I can't say if that's for certain, but apparently that is so. I like the way the movie starts. The movie starts off brilliantly, ominously, and, you know, obviously you know it's an octopus from the title, but, or it could be a squid, I suppose. It doesn't have to be an octopus. Or jellyfish. Giant killer jellyfish. Isn't that a Japanese film? Where was I? Oh, yeah, so the opening is, well, let me back up for 1 second. The movie begins in a very weird way. You're sort of inside a vehicle, turns out to be a cab, and the camera's looking out the window, and you see the shore and the water, and it's lovely. And then as the credits appear on the screen, you see a lot of shots from an interior of a cab, and like shots of cab stuff, and you hear like cab dispatch talk, like car 404, correction, car 405, go to the corner of wherever and wherever. Yeah, got it, be there. What would be the cost of taking silver from here to here? About $6. And so it's a movie called Tentacles, and you're not seeing anything octopus related, and most of the time you're not seeing the water. You're seeing the interior of a cab as it drives along and hearing the dispatch. It's a really odd choice, but it's very Asinitis as far as I'm concerned. And then someone steps out of the vehicle, and all you see is like their, you know, slacks and shoes from like their knees down. You're like, what is the big mystery? The big mystery is that I believe that is Turner, John Huston's character, and why they shot him like that to make it look like he's going to be an assassin or something isn't completely clear to me. But I'm sure it made sense to the director when he put it together. Of course, the director of the film obviously is Asinitis, and under, was it Oliver Hellman? I will get you the credits, director, writer, producer credits, when I do the final sequence about the movie. Now, we have that opening, which doesn't seem to make much sense, and that is followed by a sequence with the baby, and it's basically a woman, and she's on the edge of sort of like a grassy area, and her and her baby are hanging out, and they're sitting there, you know, and there's like a drop into the water, and they're right near the side there, and she's playing with the baby, and then a friend of hers calls over to her from a truck, and so the lady leaves the baby and runs across the street and talks to her friend for a few minutes, and her friend asks about the little fatso, which is the baby's nickname, and he sort of does a Jaws-esque thing, but not quite, because he does, you know, the thing that Spielberg does, you know, where he, you know, slowly kind of pull, like, people pass by the camera, and then each time they pass by the camera and fill up the frame, the camera jumps in a little closer. You know that thing it does? This is sort of like that, except the camera stays in one place. Occasionally it cuts to shots of the women talking, but the camera just kind of sits there staring over the truck, past the lady, across the street. You could see the baby carriage way in the background, and just these big vehicles keep driving by, and each time they go by, the music goes off a little bit, then it goes by the other way, then it goes by the other way, and I think a bus goes by, and all of a sudden the baby carriage is gone. And the mom runs over there, and yep, the baby has been snatched by the octopus. How the octopus knew the baby was there, I guess maybe smelt it or something. That's a stinky one. I'll eat that. You know, grabs the baby, and then the next scene is with this Bill Sullivan guy. Was that Bill Sullivan? I think it's Bill Sullivan. We could tell by the dental records, that's Bill Sullivan. And, yeah, a couple of teens, like, smooching on a dock, see his body rise up out of the water, and he's all torn up, and torn all the flesh off and cartilage down to the bone. What can do that to someone? A giant killer octopus? Hello? I jump around a bit, as I always do. John Huston is fine in it. Henry Fonda doesn't do too much, although he is the, being the head of Trojan Tunnels, he actually turns out to be the CEO with a heart, because one of the, his like second in command says that he did something with the drilling that they shouldn't have done, and he makes it, Fonda makes it very clear that you don't do that, not on my watch, Jack. So that's nice. He's the CEO with a heart, but the person watch for Shelley Winter, she only has a few scenes, and one of them she wears this enormously hilarious sombrero, which is just great, and and it's fun. She's there with her son and his son's friend who want to do the boat race, and there's a great moment where, like, I think she pays for their membership for the boat race, and then someone says something like, okay, you boys go over there, and I don't know, like, I'll get you an ice cream, and her son speaks, and they've got him dubbed like, thank you, mama, and then the other kid speaks and says, thank you, Mrs. Whatever, and it's like, whoa, hey, who dubbed that guy? Who dubbed that kid? Ah, he's a good time. Yeah, Shelley Winters looks a little, throughout, which is fun. It's nice to have the differing sort of folks here throughout the movie. Yeah, and she has one long chat with her younger brother, John Huston, talking about she just fooled around with some Italian guy, and she's going to have a Bloody Mary at 9 in the morning, and I don't know, how do Bloody Marys work? Because she has all the stuff she needs for Bloody Marys on a table, and that stuff has been sitting there all night. I mean, I imagine the booze is fine, but isn't the Bloody Mary mix, isn't that like tomato juice or something like that? Can that just sit out in a container, like on a table, end table, or booze table, what are those called, all night long? It just doesn't seem, I would think you need to refrigerate that, but then I'm no Bloody Mary expert. Okay, I'll be the first and the last to admit that. Let's see, what else do we got going on in the movie? That yacht, the attack on the yachts is a little more low budget than it should be, but it's still okay. The octopus hisses, which is a lot of fun. Buoy action. Oh, I told you about that one. Yeah. The closing scene is an interesting one. As I said, it kind of gets taken over by that guy who I didn't quite know who he was, and then the killer whales attack the octopus, which is actually pretty nicely done, I thought. Gosh, I hope they didn't hurt a real octopus. I don't know. They may have. It's hard to tell. But it is interesting to see, yeah, the killer whales just go in there and basically take down the octopus, which I like. There's a great moment. This has nothing to do with octopus. Is octopi of any kind, and that's when Shelley Winter's character is giving the names of her son and her son's friend to the lady to register them, and she says something on the lines of, and this is his friend, like Kevin Doherty, and the woman at the table says, and that's Doherty. Is that how you spell Doherty? I thought it was Doherty. I just like, yes, and there's automatically a C. You know, it'd be like, yes, Doherty. I don't understand Shelley Winter's performance in this, but I absolutely love it, and I wish there was more of her in it. As I said, strangely put together movie, because the octopus, you know it's an octopus all the time, before you sort of see it in full, they do a nice job of keeping it hidden. But then unfortunately they kind of keep it hidden after that, which leads me to believe they didn't have all the budget to sort of bring it to life as large as it should have been, which is unfortunate, but these things happen. Now, I like the octopus in it. I think it's nice and creepy and slimy and fun. And I wish there'd maybe been more octopus attacks. As I said, the strange disjointed nature of the guest stars who aren't going to get, or the big name stars who aren't going to get killed, alongside these random people who we never see before and really never see again until they're killed, is fine with me. It's not my favorite Asinitis film, but I do think it is worth a viewing. And that Blu-ray makes it look really nice. You know, enjoy it for the soundtrack and Shelley Winter's giant sombrero. I think that might be enough. Listen to this.
Mikey disappeared. He was surfing, and all of a sudden we didn't see him anymore.
I'm going for a swim. job, Matt. I won't forget it.
Oh, we have to prove the troublemaker's right.
You mean Benton? I wouldn't worry about him. One of the first things a politician learns is how to handle meddlers like him.
I've been killing shot most of my life. Well, you would have been right mostly about them. So I'm the expert here. And that's what's gonna take to kill a bastard.
No, damn it. That's my shark, Ron. It has to be.
The hell it is! What's the sense in risking both our necks?
Shark, and I'll buy you a lobster dinner. You're passing the buck. You're the one who wants to back out of this.
Bottom line is that you've got to be responsible for the destruction of that shark, and not by next week. Now,
local kids avenge friends dead. Kill killer shark. I can see it on the network news already.
What if your old man comes looking for his boat?
No way. He's too busy to go cruising.
Okay, take us down lower.
Tentacles. Yeah, I know I said it was 76 at the start, and I could have sworn it was 76, but I see that it came out in Italy in February of 77, which means it was probably made in late 76. So I'm sticking by 76. If you go online, some places say 76, some places say 77. I chose the 76 because I got that spirit. I really do. And I wanted to separate Tentacles, 76, Claws, 77. I'm just that way. So I know that, yeah, Tentacles was shot in La Jolla. It's just San Diego way. And I don't know, I imagine there was probably some location footage also shot, maybe in Italy, Greece, that kind of thing. I'm thinking maybe the scene with the really fat guy was probably shot somewhere in Europe. That looks pretty European. But yeah, it's another Asinitis ripoff, you know, following the great Beyond the Door. And then after this, of course, he did the really weird The Visitor, which is kind of in a class all its own, but also lots of fun. Now, there are plenty of reviews out there. I just wanted to read two. One from Psychotronic, Encyclopedia of Film, Michael Weldon's book. Ooh, and I'm flipping through. It's a lot of fun. This is a heck of a book. My copy is so old, it is almost in pieces, which is a little unfortunate, because I think it might be long out of print. But Tentacles, page 697. Producer, E.F. Doria. This is 77, AIP Italy. Director, Oliver Hellman, Ovidio Asinitis. Have I been saying his name wrong this whole time? Sigh. Well, what are you going to do? Screenwriters, Jerome Max, Tito Carpi, and Steve Carabastos. The director, Beyond the Door, an Italian Exorcist copy filmed in California, returns with an Italian Jaws copy. It's hard to convey just how boring and useless this octopus attack film is. John Huston and Shelley Winter stars Mr. and Mrs. Turner. Not quite. Henry Fonda has an immersively brief role with Bo Hopkins, Cesare Danova, and Claude Akins. The great Claude Akins. There should have been more Claude Akins in this movie. I think there should be more Claude Akins in every movie, but that's just me. So, now I'm looking at the horror film. What is this? I forget who put this out, but this is from 1989. Guide to more than 700 films on video cassette. Cinebooks Home Library Series number 4, page 230 to 231. Here we go. Tentacles, 1 star. Oh boy. 77, 102. John Huston, the makers of this Jaws ripoff were lucky enough to get John Huston, Shelley Winters, and Henry Fonda to sign on for this picture. Otherwise, we'd be completely forgotten today. As it is, it's just a footnote in the actors' respective filmographies. Outside of Fonda's minor role as an executive and Huston's equally small part as a newspaper reporter married to Winters, there isn't much to the ultra-boring tentacles. Huston isn't married to Winters, they're brother and sister. In the first scene, she says, "Have you been up all night, little brother?" Bo Hopkins does the best he can as Will Gleason, a marine biologist who trains a pair of whales to attack the killer octopus that's been strangling the town dry. That's a strange sentence. Director Ovidio Asinitis, working under his pseudonym Oliver Hellman, also produced Piranha 2, The Spawning, and was obviously trying to milk the Jaws craze for all it was worth. Killer flying piranhas? A killer octopus? What else? A killer carp or killer horses maybe? These guys, they don't seem to like horror movies. Well, what are you going to do? That happens. So that's Tentacles, everybody. So now, if you hold on to your hats, we got our next movie coming up here. And I couldn't find a trailer for it, so I'm just going to play a little snippet of something after touch of intermissionary stuff. Be right back.
We're by the old lost casket mine. Ben's going to die unless I can get him out of here.
Say again, Bear Hunt. Come in. Are you reading me? Come in, Bear Hunt.
We're by the old lost casket mine, and Chase is hurt real bad. Over.
I copied that, Mac. Keep asking them for their position.
Listen to Bear Hunt. Ben's gonna die unless I can get him out of here. By the old lost casket mine.
Repeat, Bear Hunt, this is helicopter. Bear Hunt, this is Able 2-4. Repeat, please.
Hello, helicopter.
Get up out of the clouds, bud. We're about 7-8 miles north of Devil's Paw Mountain, and the weather's still good here.
I heard. I'm right around the old glory hole. See if I can find a window and sneak through. Over.
What, can you hear me? Get up here quick before the weather closes in on us, too. Over.
Keep your shirt on good, buddy.
Get out of the clouds, bud.
I'm gonna have to sneak through the peaks and come up on the ocean side. Talk to me, Monroe. Damn, I'm going to be watching football on TV. Come on, boy, speak to me.
We're 1,500 feet above you, just north of the Paw Mountain. Come in, damn it.
I'm breaking through now. Just hang in there.
Helicopter. Hello, helicopter. We're 7-8 miles north of Devil's Paw. Over.
I'm on top. I hope you're where you think you are. Can you move him down a couple of hundred yards to a more level spot?
Claws. Oh boy. Set in Admiralty, Alaska. It begins 5 years ago with a big bear fight. Two grizzlies are in the woods. They're fighting. And nearby there is some sort of forest ranger and two hunters. and they are going to illegally shoot these grizzlies. They shoot one of them, gets away, they shoot and kill the other, but they can't take the grizzly or do, I don't know what the heck, can you do, I guess you can't haul a grizzly and throw it onto the top of your truck. I guess it's you shooting and killing a grizzly is what these jerks are after. But they have to get the heck out of there because there is a wounded, angry grizzly around. Meanwhile, we meet Chris and her husband, Jason. Jason is played by Jason Evers, the mad scientist from The Brain That Wouldn't Die, Ways. They are a happy couple. He's a logger. They're having a good time. They're collecting firewood for the winter. They're driving back to their home when the car overheats. So he gets out to go to walk into town to get some help. And she stands by. If she sees anyone driving by, she'll ask for help. The hunters drive by our logging friend very quickly. They're getting the hell out of Dodge. And then Jason is attacked by this giant angry bear. Kind of mauled pretty good, and one of his arms is really sort of punctured and in a bad way. Then we get a series of boarding house style screen printouts that tell us what's going on. Several more attacks, several people are killed, and then suddenly cuts to 5 years later, and they are now calling it the Demon Bear. Ooh, great. What is it? A giant grizzly turned rogue killer. And it's true. There's some sort of crazy job. I mean, it could be. Well, this is not the time to discuss this. But what it is it's either that bear that has got a taste of human flesh and now comes after humans, or it is some sort of devil bear, the Kustika, they call it. Sort of a Native American legend about a bear spirit that's coming around killing humans. 5 years later, unfortunately, after Jason and Chris have had their child, Bucky, Chris has left. Chris has moved into town. She's now hanging out with a guy named Howard. And Bucky is, I don't know how old Bucky's supposed to be, 6 or 7, something like that. Maybe a little bit older. He's in like a Cub Scout thing that Howard runs. And unfortunately, Jason is no longer much good to anyone. His arm doesn't work quite right and he can't really do the logging as he did. He has a good friend, his Native American friend Henry, and Henry drinks a lot of whiskey, and they hang out together and wish Chris would come back, but she's got her own life now. And what happens then is the scouts go out camping, and we keep hearing sort of intimations that the bear is nearby. There's a moment where there are a bunch of people swimming, and there's like this hippie guy with his acoustic guitar, and the commissioner shows up. The commissioner's name, I believe, is Ben. And Ben shows up, and was Ben's last name Henry? No, I was going to say Ben Henry. That's not right. I'm sorry. My mind is wandering. I've got all the names written down here and something I lost in them. So yeah, Ben shows up and he's kind of an older gentleman. He's commissioner in the area. And he talks to this hippie guy. Hey man, I'm a musician and I really know about the outdoors, man. And it's not the killer bear. It's a little cute little grizzly cub who got into the back of their truck or something like that. But unfortunately, that evening, the Cub Scouts get attacked, or whatever they are, get attacked. And several of the kids are mauled, and Henry is smacked around a bit, and Bucky is badly bruised and beaten and put into a coma. And because of the attack on children, we get a whole bunch of different sort of people assembling to try to stop the grizzly. We get a couple of very arrogant scientists who have set up a trap with a pig in it that think they're going to take care of business. We get a bunch of course, redneck hunters. We get this other guy who's played by a recognizable actor who might be a sheriff or a something or other, who's actually killed fairly quickly after he's introduced. And this sort of goes along for about 45 to 50 minutes of the movie, which is, bless you, one of my dogs just sneezed. Bless you, George. It's about a 97-minute long movie, and about 50 minutes or so in, Jason announces, as Bucky's still in a coma, that he is going to go hunt the bear himself. And he brings along Henry, who's getting older, and he brings along Ben after they have a 5-minute argument about how he's not going to bring along Ben because he's too old, and Henry comes along too. I don't remember exactly how Henry comes along. They just started the journey, and I was like, oh, it's that guy. And most of the second half of the movie, I'd say, yeah, bless you. I'm sorry. Most of the second half of the movie is this trek through the woods, sort of, you know, like the end of Jaws. They take a big, long trek through the woods, and they go from woods to higher up in the mountains where it gets snowier and colder. And I'm going to start to spoil some things here. But Henry ends up kind of going crazy. He sees the wailing women, and he has all sorts of, which are Native American women who, and he sees the wailing women, and he sees like strange like stuffed bears, and he sees random like white goats, or I don't know what, elk, I don't know what the heck they are, sort of, and he's starting to go crazy, and then he eventually gets attacked by the bear and killed. And then Howard, who wants to, oh, we got super sneezies there, George. I'm sorry, everyone. He's allergic to my synopses. That happens. And we get, yeah, Henry gets killed, and then Howard climbs a tree and says, I'm going to stay here, and I'm going to shoot the bear. And, of course, the bear knocks the tree over and kills Henry. And then there's a final sort of, there's an attack on top of a mountain where Ben is badly wounded, but a chopper comes in and takes Ben back, and Jason stays for the final confrontation with the bear. Is it the Satan bear, the devil bear? Is it just a regular bear who's just kind of ornery? We could talk about that in a minute, but first, this. Bless you, George.
Savage story of a monster tiger shark, Tintorera, that terrorized the tropical paradise they called the Island of Women.
I know I'll never find another you.
Starring Susan George as the girl who came to the island just for fun.
When you're coming home, when you're coming home.
Hugo Stiglitz as a rich young man in search of romance and adventure. Andreas Garcia as Miguel, the penniless Casanova of the coast that every woman adored. Fiona Lewis in The Perfect Island for a holiday romance.
You know, this place really is made for lovers.
But the Tintorera changed everything. Together for laughs and love until the Tintorera struck again and again.
You must be sick in the head.
Oh, it's my turn.
You're absolutely crazy.
Tintorera. Fantastic scenes of real tiger sharks in action.
I remember seeing Claws for the first time years ago and not being terribly thrilled with it. I found it rather boring. I was okay with sort of the first half. Things weren't moving that fast, but there's a weird structure to it, which we'll talk about in a minute, that kind of kept it interesting. But then when it actually got to the second half and the big sort of bear hunt, it's like Sasquatch, you know, that we've discussed on here before, but without sort of the colorful characters. And Henry's visions go on for a very long time. At first they're just weird, and you're like, what the heck is happening with Henry? And then they just go on and on. And I don't want to hop to the end just quite yet, but I remember thinking, I saw another Jaws ripoff, and this one was made entirely in Alaska. So that's something to check off on the list. This time around, I enjoyed it a lot more. I still found some of the wandering in the second half to be slightly tedious, but the structure of the film grabbed my attention. First off, the opening sequence is I think nicely put together. It starts off with that big bear fight, and you're like, whoa, my God! And at one point in the big bear fight, I don't know. I mean, they must have just set up a couple of cameras. I don't know if this is stock footage or what it is, because clearly the bears don't interact with the hunters when they're shooting them. I wouldn't think it was stock footage then, but can you train two big grizzlies to fight like that? I guess I'm not as much of an animal man as I thought. Animal man. And there's a point at the end of the big bear fight where the camera is there and the grizzlies like get right on top of and sort of bump into the camera, which is sort of, whoa, hey, guys, come on, knock it off. But they get the big bear fight, and then you get the opening sequence, and then you get that great, I'd completely forgotten about the great scrolling, typing in screen, you know, what is it, giant grizzly turned rogue killer, you know, Satan bear returns 5 years later. And then you get all the sort of soap opera shenanigans with Chris and Jason and little Bucky. And the way they do it is sort of you see Jason sleeping and he's having a dream. And in the dream, they relate all the stuff that's happened over the past few years. They're fighting all the time. Things are going bad. She's given up on him. She starts to denigrate him and his logging company. Well, don't do that. Don't be mean like that. He's having a rough time. And, you know, maybe he needs to pick it up a little bit and find something else to do. But he says, I'm a logger. Okay, well, you know, go. Is there some, maybe, I don't know, maybe go take an accounting course. You become a CPA logger or something like that. I don't know. You know, you figure if you've got a child and you've got a wife and you can't log anymore, as it were, because your arm is damaged, you got to find something else. Sitting around saying that you are something that you can't do anymore is not helping anyone. So she goes and she meets up with Howard, and Howard is great because until Howard gets mauled, Howard is one of the smarmiest guys around. Just the way he refers when he talks to Ben about the bear, he's just so sort of smarmy about it, and it's like you don't want to see him get attacked by a bear, but he gets attacked by a bear, and it's not unfunny. No, I'm kidding, of course. During the we get the odd structure starts to come out. And during the camping sequence, where you see all the kids together, and two of the kids sneak out, and then when they're coming back, Howard thinks it's the bear, and he pulls the rifle on him. It's the two kids, and you can see he's like really shaken up because he was about to shoot these two kids. Don't shoot, Mr. Whatever your name is. Don't shoot. And these two little pricks went out in the middle of the night when they weren't supposed to, and Howard's like shaking, and then we get the neat thing that sort of the structure of the film does it does it a little bit after this, until the hunt begins, which is that the movie sets us down in this campsite, and we don't know who any of these people are, and then as he's standing there, we get a flashback to him talking to Ben, and Ben saying, maybe you shouldn't take the kids out there, no, I'm gonna take the kids out there, and then Chris shows up, and you see Chris kiss Howard, and you're like, oh, okay, and then she leaves, and Ben says something like, don't you think you're kind of intruding upon this family? You know, this is the time when Bucky usually goes with Jason. No, I'm going to take care of the kid. And of course, if Bucky had been with Jason, he would have gotten mauled. And then later on, when after the mauling, there's a scene where Howard's been is all bruised, and he runs into Chris, and she looks at him, and they have another flashback to when he convinces her to take Bucky out on the camping trip, and he says, I promise he'll be all right. And then it goes back to her, and she says, you promised. And so there's this kind of neat thing it does. I'm about to bring up a point that I've just thought of on the fly here, but I did forget to say that the movie, is written by Chuck D. Keene and Brian Russell. Chuck D. Keene also produced it, and I believe he photographed it, and it's directed by Richard Bansbach and Robert E. Pearson. Normally you don't see two people directing a movie like this, and if you do, sometimes it means there's trouble. And I'm wondering if this interesting structure of the way they sort of do this, where they'll put you down in the center of something, and then they'll stop it and give you a flashback to sort of show some setup, and then return to it. And it's kind of a neat way to do something. I haven't really seen a movie kind of do that before, but I'm wondering if that wasn't an issue with maybe, you know, they shot the movie and put it together and people were like, well, who are these people? How did they get there? Well, how about we have to go to, and they brought in a second director to shoot these flashback scenes that they sort of inserted in. I don't know that for certain. This could be the way the script is written. It's a very odd way to write a script, if you think about it, to sort of have all these scenes where you're suddenly introduced to all these people, and then at a certain point in the scene, you flash back to a scene that would have been the normal expositional people being introduced to a scene, and then you return to the thick of things. It does speed things up a bit, which is nice, because most of the last third of the movie is going to be a bunch of guys walking through woods and snow. But I kind of like it, and I've forgotten that the structure of the movie did this, and I haven't really seen anyone kind of mention that this is done. I think it's rather unique. I'm sure other films have done this, but it's sort of like going forward immediately and then taking a step back and then continuing to go forward. And it loses that in the second half of the movie, but of course it would because they're on the hunt now. But I really like that. And then it does an interesting thing too after the, because for, you think the movie's going to be all about Jason, for the first half of the movie it barely is. And there are a series of scenes after the attack on the kids. First you get a great scene where Ben is interviewed by a guy from the paper and a guy from the local TV at the same time, and he ends up punching out the guy from the interviewer from the local television station, and people begin to act really weird over the course of these scenes because and I just realized the interviewer from the local news looks a lot like the guy who runs the drive-in in Drive-In Massacre. You know that guy who calls, what is it, Wormy or whatever his name is? Little Piece of Puke? Yeah, Piece of Puke. I forget what his name is, but Johnson, I think, is... I was going to say Navin Johnson, but that's not right. There are suddenly a series of weird, I don't know if they're weird scenes, but sort of scenes that don't actually go anywhere, that take up about 15 to 20 minutes of the film, where you, right after the scene with the interviewers, you get that ranger from the beginning who shot the bear and caused all the trouble from the first place. You suddenly are introduced to two scientists who are like big game trappers, man-eater trappers, and they're so wonderfully, one of them has a pipe, so you can see how pretentious they're going to be. And Sam is like, well, do you really know bears? Man-eaters are all the same, Commissioner. We're going to take care of it. Well, remember, grizzlies are pretty smart. They're not as smart as we are. Well, no, I wasn't saying that. Keep in mind, they're pretty smart. This isn't a devil bear or whatever. They're so condescending. It's hilarious. And, spoiler, they get ripped apart by the bear. The bear actually, it goes into their trap briefly, apparently, and then literally crashes through the front door of the cabin they're in and kills the three of them. And does that weird thing where, that sort of slasher film killers do, where when the commissioner opens the door, the one of the scientists' body has been like kind of up above the door or something. It does that thing where it suddenly swings down into his face covered with blood, and you're like, whoa, the bear did that? That's like a Michael Myers, Jason thing to do. You know, that's not something that you think bears would do. But the bear does have a feel of sort of almost a proto-slashery thing, simply because of the way that it is a giant bear. And yet on more than one occasion, someone will be standing in the middle of the frame. And this could be a framing thing, I don't know, because obviously, we'll talk about some odd conversational things that the movie does in a minute. But there's this scene like when Howard gets killed. He's knocked out of this tree. He's standing in the middle of the frame looking around. And then all of a sudden, it goes to slow-mo. And the bear lurches in from the left side of the frame and knocks him over completely silently. Can bears do that? I mean, it's like a jump scare with a 10-foot-tall, 500-pound grizzly bear. Is that actually something that's scientifically possible? I don't know, but it happens more than once. And makes the bear at times feel very slashery. And even in the end, during the climax, when Jason, he's in like an old like disused like train yard or something like that, and he's walking by like a shed or something, and he hears something. He turns, sees something move inside the shed, and the bear leaps out of the shed at him. And I thought, whoa, that is very slashery. It's sort of a, you know, it's Final Girl variation chase at the end. And with the tricky thing being, of course, that you can't have the bear in the shot with them that often. So it's a lot of him turning and looking and then cutting to the bear. Roar! And then him going, whoa, crap, it's a bear. And then he ends up attacking the bear with an axe. But, you know, you can't, you're not going to bury the axe in the giant bear. So it's a slightly weird sequence in the end, in the end there. But let me just go to something that, oh, I have my note here, is those scientific goofs. Talking about those two scientists. There's a weird thing it does that reminded me of one of my favorites, Dark Side of Midnight. And that's, there's a lot of conversations, and this could be a reframing thing going from whatever the actual, and we'll talk about this in the next segment, whatever the actual aspect ratio of the film was to get it into 1:3:3. But there are a lot of scenes when, especially the scene about like 50 or so minutes in, when Jason and Ben argue about whether or not Jason's going to go on this hunt and whether Ben's going to be with him, where it's just the camera will be on Jason. You see Jason's face and he says, "You're too old to go up there." Immediately cut to Ben. "I am not." Cut to Jason. "You are too." Cut back to Ben. "I can go up there. I'm not that old." Cut to Jason. "Well, I get that." And after a time, all this cutting back and forth and never sort of getting like the establishing shot of the two of them next to each other begins to look very funny. And occasionally it looks like a sort of reframing job for the VHS or television print or whatever it would have been, where it could have been one person was on the left side of the frame, one person was on the right side, and we sort of cut, we had to cut the frame in half and go back and forth. But that scene, it looks more like he's, like Jason and them, like Jason's sort of looking over our left shoulder, and you know, Ben is sort of looking over our right shoulder. So it looks like that was a cutting back and forth kind of thing. And I use Dark Side of Midnight because Dark Side of Midnight is filled with conversations where it's just, well, the police chief just called him Brock Johnson. Cut. He can't do that. Cut. He did. Cut. Well, I'm going to have a say in this. Cut. And it's just, that's not really the way you do things. You need to, you know, come over the shoulders would be nice. You never see any of the over the shoulders, which makes me think that maybe Claus was poorly reframed. So many films, when they went from their theatrical aspect ratio to 1:3:3, were just cut. Ugh, yuck. This one, it's tough to tell sometimes, but that is something that happens that you can use to amuse yourself, especially during that scene where Ben and Jason argue, because it seems to literally go on forever. "You're too old." "I am not." "You're too old." "I'll make it up there." "How are you going to make it up there?" "I'm going to get up there just like you will." "But you're too old." "I am not." "Yes, you are." "I'll make it." And it just, it's like this circular conversation that goes on for, it seems like, days. Then there's the other thing the film does too, where there are moments, you know, like I said, where it's where it introduces a bunch of people. Like at one point, it introduces a slew of rednecks who are going out to take care of the grizzly on their own, and some sort of recognizable character actor sort of shows up as like a ranger or something. And he's there, and it's like, who is this guy? And then suddenly he goes in the woods, and he's going to shoot some deer. He thinks it's the bear. And then the bear actually leaps on him, slashes. Like, literally, like, the bear seems to be 3 feet away, and he can't see the bear, and it leaps on him. And you're thinking, who is this guy? Where did he come from? And where did all those rednecks we saw a few minutes ago go? And why spend so much time with the scientists when they're just killed off like that after they set up the trap? And they're all, like I said, too, it's like, wait a minute, Howard's on the trek with them, and I thought Ben wasn't going to go on the trek. And there's so many weird moments where it's like, I just looked away for a second, and now I no longer know what's going on. Maybe there was a problem. That's why they called in a second director. The movie does a thing at the end. I guess this is spoilery, where where Jason is on top of like a little open lean-to almost kind of shack, and the bear is underneath it swatting around, and the bear accidentally swipes at a canister that has next to it in big letters the words "gas" written, and the gas sprays all over the bear, and you think at that point they're going to set the bear on fire. In fact, that's what they do, but it takes a very long time for it to happen. There's a lot of the axe swinging, and then Chris and this helicopter pilot. We have to talk about the rescuing Ben helicopter pilot sequence. Chris, now that Bucky's awake, Chris wants to get out there and, you know, save, get out there and bring Jason back to see Bucky. And she's in this helicopter with the helicopter pilot, and she grabs the flare gun, not knowing that it's covered with gas, but she just grabs the flare gun and leaps out of the helicopter. And a weird thing happens where the bear knocks Jason over, and Jason goes, kind of was rolling down a hill. And I must have looked to my right, because when I looked back, he was hanging off a cliff like 100 feet above like the ground. I'm like, how the hell did he get there? But they never actually fully establish how he's hanging off of it. So it's just like you kind of looking down at his face, and then he looks down, and then it cuts to a shot of the cliff, and you're like, whoa, hey, there needs to be another shot in there that establishes what's going on. Or maybe I missed it. Again, I did, you know, when the commissioner there, Ben, meets the scientists, I didn't actually see any scientific equipment, but he says, so this is what you're going to use to catch the big grizzly, huh? Yep. And I thought, what are they going to use? I didn't see it. This could be my problem. Maybe I should, maybe Claws is the movie you don't take your eyes off of. During the climax, there are one too many moments where things are knocked out of people's hands by the bear, and then they have to struggle to get them back. At the end, there's a really weird moment. I don't know why they did this. Maybe this is like an Alaskan machismo kind of thing, but Chris leaps out, and she's got the flare gun, but she can't get it to work. For some reason, she can't get it to work. Then she's knocked over, and Jason rushes up, and he grabs the flare gun, and he's pointing it. And I want to say it gets knocked out of his hand. I actually forgotten now. But let's say it. Let's say the flare gun got knocked out of his hand. And so he has to go after the flare gun again. It's like, well, that's one knocking things out of your hand too far right there. Because you know he's going to get set on fire because he got sprayed by the gas. So pick it up. You know, we all make mistakes. If this was their first film, hey, my first student films back in the day are garbage. So, you know, my first scripts and stories and reviews are not very good. So I can see that, but it's just like the suspense isn't being extended here in a good way. It's just kind of an annoying way. And then we'll do this, and then I'll start to wrap it up because there's so many fun things in the movie. Oh, and I just, before I forget, the credits roll, and I believe the family is the Monroes. It's Jason Monroe, it was Chris Monroe, and it's Buck Monroe. The weirdest thing about the credits as they roll is, you know, Jason is Jason Evers, Chris is played by whoever she's played by, Buck Monroe is played by Buck Monroe. Huh? What? A secondary character that we see for 5 minutes is actually named after the actor who's playing him, and they named the parents Monroes too? That's just so weird. You know, it's not like, say, Stefania Stella in Fatal Frames plays Stefania Stella. She was the star of that movie. That movie's a vanity vehicle for her. This is like a, not even a secondary, this is like a tertiary character. You know, I just thought it was amusing. And what the heck happens to all those rednecks? Anyway, they're in this couple of scenes and then they just vanish. And is this the Satan bear? I don't know. But the one last thing, a sequence that I found alternately hysterical and drove me up the wall, is they're in constant, when they're on the hunt, they're in constant CB transmission back to, or I'm sorry, radio transmission back to, it's me, I love CBs, I try to make everything a CB, back to town. And there's just a sequence where Ben gets hurt. Hey, calling, you know, bear hunt to base, we need a helicopter out here, we'll send a helicopter out, and they keep losing him and come back, and so the guy gets in the helicopter, and you see him flying, you don't see him, you see the camera going through lots of clouds, and it's really tough to make out what's going on. He says, the weather's really bad, there are lots of clouds up here, and he keeps talking, and it's really, the cutting in between him and the helicopter, and what we're not really seeing because their clouds is confusing, and then it cuts to Jason saying, you know, bear hunt to helicopter one. We're 7 miles past this ridge, this peak. Okay, bear hunt, this is helicopter one. I'm flying through clouds now. The bear hunt, this is the, I'm I'm going to lose myself in this. But it's basically, it comes down to this weird sequence where it's like, you know, you got to get out of the clouds, helicopter one. Bear Hunt, I'm about to get out of the clouds. Where are you at? 7-8 miles from the peak. All right, let's hope you're there. I'm still in the clouds. You got to get out of the clouds. Okay, I'm going to get out of the clouds. And cuts in between Jason standing there with the radio and the guy in the helicopter in the clouds. You got to get out of the clouds. Okay, Bear Hunt, we got to get out. And this seems to, this is like the argument that Jason has with Ben. It seems to go on for 8 days. And almost the entire time, there are these shots of clouds and things, and you can't make out anything. And then suddenly he arcs over the top of a mountain and sees Jason a moment later. And it's such an, ultimately, like I said, annoying, frustrating, and kind of hilarious scene because, you know, it's, all right, I'm almost out of the clouds, here I come. You gotta get out of the clouds, I'm almost out of the clouds. And it's, what the hell are they doing? What the hell's going on? Ah, Claws. I had fun with it this time around, and I will just end my discussion here before I go on for days. Two more things. One, there's a bit where Chris, first she talks to Henry, then she talks to Ben, and when Henry says something to her, and she says, "Oh, Henry," and I was thinking, "I loved your Gift of the Magi. Some of your twists were fantastic." And then a scene later, she's talking to Ben, and it starts off with going, "Uncle Ben, I don't know what to do." And I thought, maybe try some of my minute rice. Maybe. So that's one more thing. Jason is standing with Henry talking in the beginning and after the mauling and after Chris is gone. Chris and Bucky are gone. Buck Monroe, that is. And Jason's sort of standing there cradling his left arm, which has the wound on it. And they're talking about the bear. And Henry says something like, "It's still out there, Jason." And Jason says, "Oh, someday I'll find him. The rainbow connection, the lovers, the dreamers, and me." That's exactly what I thought when he said that. "Someday I'll find him." And then I started singing. So Claws, it'll make you think, it'll make you laugh, it'll make you cry. It might freak you out with how slasher filmy the giant grizzly bear is. And it'll make you sing. Now this.
Evil has visited the earth in many forms. Now it returns as the car.
There was no driver in the car.
A car possessed.
I know why he didn't go into the cemetery. The ground was hallowed.
Can stop the car.
This is Wade. We can't let him through no matter what.
Stay in close. Kill our sister.
There's nowhere to turn.
The car, he's in here.
Nowhere to hide. No way to stop the car.
I think I hear the engine of that car. It's around here somewhere. Wait, I'm scared. No, I promise you I won't go out. Tell me what to do, baby.
What evil force drives the car?
All right, everyone. Claws was made in Juneau, Alaska. So it's an actual full-on Alaskan production. It's not a... It's what is it? It's Alaska Pictures made it. And that's kind of cool. Exploitation from Alaska. And as has been pointed out in many places, technically, this movie is riding the coattails of Grizzly. which was a Jaws ripoff. So technically Claws is a Jaws ripoff, but it's a ripoff of a Jaws ripoff, and that's pretty fun. It certainly uses the locations in Alaska very nicely, especially as it gets near the end and you see the mountains and the snow. I think it's really quite lovely. The IMDb says it was shot scope 2.35, which would explain some of the odd framing that I mentioned. But I don't know if it explains all the odd framing, to be honest. Some, like I said, some of the conversations look very Dark Side of Midnight-y, back and forth kind of person. My bet would be that it was shot 1.85, not 2.35, because it doesn't look terribly panned and scanned on the video gems print. It just looks like there are definitely some shots that are sort of, you know, two people in frame, but they're on the opposite sides of the frame, so they sort of cut it in half. So you see the one head, then it cuts to the other. But I can't tell for all of them if that's what's happening. The argument between Ben and Jason looks like the camera is cutting from one to the other. It doesn't look like they're standing on either side, because they're looking towards the camera, not sort of sideways. So I would love to see a decent print. I would love to see it in its proper aspect ratio. Hey, Grizzly got a Blu-ray. Why not a film that apparently was called Grizzly 2 when it came out? I looked around for posters and such, or ad mats or something that said that. I didn't see any, but IMDb claims that. They could be wrong. There's also a claim that it was called Devil Bear also. And that sounds more likely. And also Bear Tooth. I'm not 100% sure on that. But I'd like to read just a few reviews here before we wrap this episode up. I'm going to hop to Nightmare USA here. And page 430, the great Stephen Thrower book. This is a serviceable afternoon adventure film with one furry foot in the horror genre, thanks to some goring of victims and the emphasis on the Indian supernatural visions of wailing women, foretelling his doom. Visions which the film backs up is genuine. The Grizzlies attacking a Boy Scout camp is amusing for sure, and slightly bloodier than you might expect. But this remains an adventure movie with horror elements, rather than the other way around. I confess I'm including it here mainly because it happened to have been shot in Alaska, Juneau to be precise. Evers traveled to the other end of the country, Miami, Florida, later the same year to star in Barracuda for Wayne Crawford and Harry Kerwin. So that's an I think I like it more than he does. I did watch it on a Saturday afternoon, and I mostly enjoyed it, as I said. And we're gonna hop now to the great and wonderful Psychotronic Video Guide, Mike Weldon's Psychotronic Video Guide, page 109. Claws. A spirit bear kills people in a national park in this Jaws-inspired horror movie made after the similar Grizzly, 1976, with Jason Evers, Ken Gampu, Myron Healy, veteran actor Leon Ames, and Anthony Caruso. It was filmed in Alaska. You bet your ass it was. And oddly enough, after what Stephen Thrower said about it not being really a horror film, I'm turning to the Encyclopedia of Horror Films from Phil Hardy for our last bit here. Page 320, Claws, a.k.a. Devil Bear. This says 90 minutes. The one I watched was 97. I wonder if maybe that's a PAL adjustment thing or something. Like Grizzly, 1976, this Jaws, 1975, inspired outing features a huge bear on the rampage, this time in the wilds of Alaska. Although here the story is given supernatural overtones by the suggestion that perhaps the creature is the Kutuka. Kutuka. What am I calling it? I thought it was Kustika. This is Kutuka, a kind of Bigfoot of Indian legend. But as in the case of its predecessor, the bear evokes as much sympathy as terror, especially in the light of remarks like a few well-placed slugs will turn him into a rug. True. So that is Claws, everyone. I'd recommend it. I like Grizzly. I think it's fun. But as I said, I kind of prefer Claws. So let's do one more little treat right here, and we will come back and wrap up episode 11.
Sleek, fierce, savage, deadly, the piranha. For centuries, nature's most ferocious killer. Until now. The new breed is here. faster, more ferocious, and infinitely more deadly. Piranha 2.
It's tremendous jaw pressure. It's sheared cleanly through bone in places.
It's here. It's alive. It's multiplying.
We spliced in genes from different species to create the ultimate killer organism.
It lives in the depths of the sea, but it can strike anywhere.
Loretta!
A super breed of killer fish that can swim, fly, and attack at any time. They bred the ultimate killing machine. Now, you're not safe out of the water. Piranha 2, Flying Killers.
And that's our Jaws ripoff episode, everybody. As I said, Tentacles is available on a Blu-ray, double feature with Reptilicus. Claws, you gotta go the old video gems route for that one. But I think they're both worth watching. They're both a good time. I will probably watch Claws again now. Maybe not soon, but I'll probably watch it again. So, Dan's Drive double feature number 11 ends. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'm not sure what we got on tap for next time. I promise it's going to be fun. But where can you find us online? Well, obviously, iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud. You can look up eventually Supertrain. You can look up Dan's Drive In Double Feature. That's Drive-In Double Feature. Then where are we? Eventually Supertrain.blogspot.com. You can email us at esupertrain@yahoo.com. You can go to esupertrain1 on Twitter. You can go to Eventually Supertrain, which is the Facebook page. And I still got a bunch of reviews up over Bleeding Skull. I've got stuff at the Some Polish American Guy Reviews Things blog. I got stuff everywhere. Look around for it. It's going to be fun. Made for TV Mayhem Show, Podcast Mania. It's all great stuff. So, until the next time, stay out of the water, stay out of the woods. Pretty much don't leave your living room because something is going to get you. And particularly in a nice place. No, probably try to eat you and strip you down to the bone. Even your cartilage. That's a little gross, isn't it? So this is Dan signing off, everyone. And until next time, see you at the movies. No, wait. I'm sorry. That was Siskel and Ebert, wasn't it? See you in the drive-in. I'll think of something better next time. Forget about it. Here, we'll go to this.
Instinctively, man has always been drawn to the sea. Its beauty, its mystery, its secrets. But there is also a vague uncertainty, a sense of intrusion into an alien world where man is unwelcome and completely at the mercy of the most terrifying predator on Earth. Man's deepest fear has risen again. Jaws, the revenge. This time, it's personal.